On this week's show, discussing, are we moving from Total Station to lasers with William St. Pierre from Mechassist. In this week's news, Gen Z is moving from college to trade schools.
Construction is the world's oldest industry but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right, we're back. Jonathan, we got a show about lasers, man. Total Stations, the evolution. It had to be you. It had to be you, my man.
Thank you so much. You know, my first entrance into tech was my boss literally dropping a Trimble in my office and saying, learn how to use this.
Well, and now I've got this guy, William, that's going to say it's time to move on to a laser. William St. Pierre, how you doing, man?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for hosting me on the show today.
Excited to have you. Thanks for jumping on me on LinkedIn and saying, if you think that's cool, you should check out a laser. So, you know, with that, let's get into our interview. All right, William. So tell me a little bit about how you got here. Your story is a little different than some of the ones we have on here. And, so tell me a little bit about your backstory.
Yeah, definitely. So, at the beginning, I think we need to be a little bit crazy to start an adventure like mine, right? Because we're playing with deep hardware and optics, photonics. So it gets very complex quickly. But we're three co-founders in the business. Myself, I'm a construction engineer. My two other co-founders are mechanical engineer and system engineering. So definitely we have quite some good background to develop the product that we have. And we founded the journey quite early in our career. We've met at the university. We went to work a little bit and then quickly started our business afterwards. And it was different, I believe, from the other ones, because at the beginning, we were not doing laser projection at all. We had developed a large 3D printer to print fiberglass to build 3D wall panels, basically. And yeah, we've realized that it was a bit complicated on the technology side, but also the customer just didn't want this. So we made a major pivot of our business back. That was about 4 years ago. We made a major pivot of our business to build what we've built today, laser projection, and our life changed since then.
Well, it's an interesting story because there's two things in there. I think, John, you'll probably want to know more about like the pivot away from the wall panel thing. But for me, just in general, like there is this story of founders that get so, I don't know, married to a solution and can't pivot from it. So tell me a little bit about what, you know, that process of sitting down, because it has been very interesting to hear that. Like, how hard and how close were you to not making that pivot?
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, the line between perseverance and stupidity is quite thin, right? And you got to gauge yourself, making sure that you're not stupid at the end and continuing on a journey that you're heading into a wall. But yeah, so basically we did not have any customers for the laser for the 3D wall panels, and then we visited on a job site trying to sell our product to a wall and ceiling contractor, and it was clearly not interested. It was quite funny, actually. So I would see it clearly, and at the end of the meeting, we just said, like, "Hey, why are you not interested? I mean, it can clearly be seen." He told me, "William, I'm very happy you asked me this because I'm not interested in your product. My real problem is not to assemble my walls faster on the job site, but it's to know where the walls will be positioned. On my last job, we just lost $1 million because of a bad location of a wall on the project, and it was crucial for us." So then we took that in and decided to make a major pivot. So we cold called several contractors, ready to make sure that we were not stupid, right? And we wanted to validate this information with more contractors. And out of those contractors that we've been able to cold call, a few of them gave us money to build a product. And that's how it started. So we decided to make the pivot officially. And we built the first prototype we've built was very ugly, to be honest. We called it Wall-E. But it got us to be able to raise some capital and build a team and so on and so forth. So it was a tough moment. It was not easy at all, but we did it. And now I'm happy about that.
It highlights two things. One, very few people can see the disappointment and the disinterest in their potential customers' eyes. I've watched many a narcissistic CEO blast right through that and say, "No, they love it. Didn't you see it?" And I'm like, "No, all I saw was disappointment and despair." So the strength to ask that question, the empathy to see it in your customer or potential customer, but then you guys had to have impressed them in the process is what I think is interesting for them to actually say, "All right, well, like these are three smart people and they tried, but hey, that's not our problem. Like, here's our problem." And allowed you to pivot. Good thing to check up on your resources. You know, check references out there. Anybody listening, you know, every contractor has a different problem, but you'll find that many of them are very similar. And so that can drive you. John, I'm wondering what questions there you have before we let them go down the road and tell us about what actually came out of this thing.
Well, that's not a minor pivot. You know, like 3D printing walls and then moving to doing lasers that are going to do layout, I mean, is a completely different sort of animal. So I am curious about give me a little more detail on the pivot itself. Like, because you've spent some money, not an insignificant amount of money, doing major amount of work to come up with some 3D prototypes, I would imagine, of the wall panels that you're going to build and the equipment that you're going to use to do it. And to move from those ideas to lasers, like, I could see you moving from, "Hey, we don't want to do walls," to, "We'll do catch basins," or, "We'll do something else using, you know, the core technology." But were you still early enough that there wasn't a lot of like hardware or technical debt involved?
Yeah, we were quite early in our process for the 3D printers. So we did not have any problems, financial problems in doing that pivot. But it was tough, you know, and clearly, so Charles, our CTO, had worked with optics and photonics before at Pratt & Whitney. But the first question went, because Charles had the idea initially. We had a bunch of ideas. We thought about printing robots. We thought about augmented total station. We thought about large carpet that we unrolled on the project and that we just placed. You know, that was stupid. But Charles had the idea of a laser projector and using laser galvanometers. So it sounds amazing. So the first question I asked him is, "Are you able to build it?" And he told me yes, quite confidently. But I know that if I would, if you would have the knowledge of today, and I would ask the same question back then, he would tell me, "No, we don't do this. It's too complicated." So we got it a little bit stupid to get into that journey. But at the end, we prevailed. And that's what makes us strong right now.
You know, it's really interesting that you were talking about AR and thinking about doing sort of an AR version of this, because I think that for a long time, I've moved between, will AR address this challenge or will the lasers? And I've started to move over to the lasers. I'm not big on the printers that go around your job site because the nature of the job site's very messy and it's hard to get stuff done. Lasers seem to do well there. When people are using this, because the problem with augmented is, right, everybody's got to have it. It's not showing up. This shows up for everybody. We can collaborate around this. If I look over and your wall's in the wrong spot, I can actually walk over to you and say, "Hey, your wall's in the wrong spot," and you can see why. But what kind of, you know, what were you thinking when you said, we think that this is the way that layout is going to be solved? Like, what are some of the key things that you think make the laser the right solution for that problem?
Yeah. So collaboration is a big aspect of it. Having a projected layout on the floor and then multiple people can see it at the same time is super important. Second one is accuracy. I mean, if you're not accurate, you're just not in the business, right? And we believe that in order to bring augmented reality in a fluid way on a project would be very complicated to do so. So because you're moving on your project, you need to have big spaces, you need to move on, multiple people needs to see the exact same thing at the exact same time, right? So that's why we believe that laser projection is the best. And compared to printing robots, we love the solution. It's very great for some types of projects, but I would say that 70% of the layout market happens on the ceiling, right? For all MEP application and so on and so forth. So this is why we believe that the laser projection was flexible in this way to be able to project on floor, walls, ceilings, all at the same time. So for us, it was a no-brainer. We decided to move into that direction for those three reasons: accuracy, flexibility, and collaboration between the trades.
And I saw one thing that was super juicy, and I want to bring it up just so I don't forget to bring it up. Did you say that you're starting to, on the software side, starting to work in with some reality capture that can backfeed into your system to give you a better idea what's there?
Yeah, exactly. So we're not only displaying information in the field. In order to be accurate, we have a feedback loop system that we can capture environment's detail. So we have 3D point cloud images, we have productivity rates and so on and so forth. And then we can value those data back into our platform afterwards. It's very useful for general contractors, I would say, even large subcontractors as well, depending on the types of project. But yes, and it was a necessity for us. And that was one of the toughest moments into the product development cycle, is to get to that feedback loop. Because otherwise, if you're not accurate and the machine doesn't know why, well, it's just going to be not accurate at the end, right? So yes, we've built that feedback loop and we're able to monetize it and add value to our customers afterwards.
Well, that's awesome. But what we're going to have to do is bring you back to the beginning and tell us what it is you actually have built, you know, because John's getting you to the feedback loop and everybody listening hasn't had the time ahead of time to know what it is that you've built. So William, break it down. What is it that you have for us, and how is it really solving? What was that problem? You know, you talked about the wall problem. So, but how did you go about solving that, and where are you today? Because it's a cool story, man.
Yeah. So we developed a laser projection device that displays construction plan with very high accuracy, so 1 millimeter accuracy, onto any surface of a construction project. So it's quite simple to operate. So it's a projector. I think we see it right next to me. It's a projector mounted on a tripod, very similar to a total station, I would say. So you have three main aspects of our product. We have the hardware, for which we are designers and manufacturers. We have a mobile application, and then we also have a web application. So the workflow goes as this. So basically, the contractors drag and drop their CAD file into our web application. As soon as it's shared with everyone into their profile, they can access to the job site and connect to their mobile device. They'll fetch their plans, and then they can work on offline or online, depending on their project. And then they start connecting to the device, and then control the device, and then they can start projecting. One of the big steps for us is the positioning process, right? Because we're not selling our tools exclusively to surveyors. So we're selling to plumbers, carpenters, so they don't necessarily have the knowledge of a surveyor to operate surveying equipments. So we have three ways to position our device. We have, as we call, control lines, control points, but also artifacts. And an artifact is basically everything that you have in the CAD file that is also in the reality, like an elevator shaft, a concrete column, whatsoever you have in the field that you can position to, you can position your device. Of course, the types of elements you will choose for your positioning may impact your overall accuracy afterwards. But in all cases, will always be 1 to 3 millimeters accurate to your reference points or reference lines all the time. You're positioned. Then you can start rotating, choosing your angle of projection. Then you press projection. And at the moment you project, just before, there's a scanning process that happens. We scan the surface you need to have so that we can measure deflection of the floor or the ceilings or the wall. Then we correct the data without the user knowing. And then what we project is fully accurate. So this is how it goes. Then you rotate your machine to the next orientation. You complete an entire donut. And as soon as you've completed your donut, then you move your station to the next station and you repeat until your job's done.
You know, when you talk about positioning, the early positioning for non-surveyors really happened with like scanning, where they would give us these spheres because the scanner could read a sphere in a circle and could figure out where the point was in the center of it and kind of lock in. And that was necessary because of the changing nature of the job site. Have you found with the artifacts, because this is the first time I've heard somebody using artifacts of, you know, with their product, have you found that being something that people gravitate towards, or are they still gravitating towards more the survey style of locating your device on their job?
It highly depends on the types of structures that we see on the project. Like we have some project in Europe right now. They use a lot of concrete, right? And in every apartment, there's a concrete walls. And then they just point into the concrete walls to position quickly. They don't need to have control lines and control points within every unit, right? So for them, it's very easy. Well, as for North America, we mostly have open decks. So you would have control lines or control points. So this is what people would use most of the time. So it highly depends on your type of construction. I would say that most of our customers right now use control lines and artifacts. And then in the MEP space, it's mostly control lines and control points that contractors are using.
One other thing that I thought was really juicy is, that doesn't happen a lot, is you talked about projecting up. I have seen ones that project on walls. I haven't seen a lot that project accurately on decks above. The below, it's no big deal. Above, it's problematic in some ways. Are you seeing that catch on with the people that are currently using it? Is that a common thing to project up to get, you know, whether it's hangar locations or light locations or attachers?
Yeah, exactly. And so yes, projecting up is one of a huge feature. And we have two types of customers that we use ceiling projection. So we have BIM contractors, and then we have non-BIM contractors, right? And they would use the product a little bit differently. So non-BIM contractors, they would just project the entire dock. And then through their experience, they know where to position the anchors and so on and so forth, and they can move on. Whereas for a BIM project, it will just extract all their point data similar to a total station, and it will just project the anchors. But we can add a level of detail that is additional to total station. So we project across, that is the point location or the hangar location. But we can also project the anchor ID or even like the anchor depth. So there's multiple details that we can add on that at the end saves times for the installation of the anchors. And that's the core goal, is to remove completely marking and then use the projection to install materials right away.
I think if I CAD yours, I might end up moving it from room to room so fast and being like, hey, I'm going to move it in here. It's going to project on the floor. Everybody come in, mark up your stuff. And then I'm going to move it to the next room. And then the next room versus alive. But for all of you MEP contractors that are used to dealing with your embeds covered up by insulation, just think how nice it would be if somebody could label all those embeds and tell you which ones are ductwork and which ones are plumbing and what hangar goes where. Because I'm telling you, William, this is a real pain, as we'll put in all our embeds into the concrete. Insulation contractor come through, spray them all. We now have no idea what is up there, if indeed we can even see it. So I love that. I definitely would, after this, we should talk more.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, we have some, developed some features to make the job easier on the projects as well. So basically we have layers, people can control by layers so that they have hangers, they have electrical boxes whatsoever. If they perform multi-trade layout, for example, they can see everything individually all at the same time. And as soon as something is laid out, which means it has been scanned, we are tracking progress. So you see this green into your device and you know what's done, you know what's not done, and what's left to be proceeded. So that helps.
And I know John focuses on the MEPs, but you're actually finding more with framers, et cetera. Why do you think that is, William? Why do you think that it's sort of landing there? I see all the use cases and I didn't even think about it, because you can throw that thing up and when it's been insulated now, John, they can just see the depth. They can see which hangers there. It's like, dude, those are huge accidents. Like, that's huge rework and arguments and RFIs or change orders or whatever. I mean, whatever you want to call it right now that we argue about in the field, but you're finding that this is, and I don't want to call it down market because that calls my, my framers, et cetera. Like there's a different level. It's just, this isn't who's normally had the need for this type of technology, but now they are. And yours is the one they're gravitating towards, right? They're the other ones have existed for MEP the entire time, but they haven't gravitated towards it. So now they are for you. What's that difference?
Yeah. So right now we are supporting 14 different trades, mostly for building works, right? But we started with wall and ceiling contractors because per our analysis, we believe that was the low-hanging fruit because they all use tape measures right now. It's very uncommon that a wall and ceiling contractor uses total station. They start to get there, but it was a low-hanging fruit on our side. So we started with wall and ceiling contractors, and then we've adapted the product to wall and ceiling contractors, and then we started to convert some of the large MEP contractors here in Canada to work with our system, and then we adapted it for the MEP. So this is where we deploy the control point positioning, for example. So we adapted it. And then right now we're starting to replace the fleet of total stations from our customers. So it's a question of priorities at the end. So now, again, we're moving onto other trades such as tiling, prefabrication operations as well. Formwork as well. We've done some project for formwork. So really, we try to position our product as a real competitor to the total stations. That's our real competitors at the end.
So definitely one of the biggest barriers to entry with the other technologies out there is the BIM. When you said you had non-BIM contractors using it, and I can understand with the way that you're doing sort of your location that that might actually be a decent idea. Without that barrier to entry, are you seeing a lot of interest from contractors that just aren't ready to make the BIM state, stretch yet, but are ready for some help in layout?
Yeah, definitely a lot.
percentage of your new customers, I guess, are part of that? Because there's a lot of people that listen to the show that are thinking about getting into BIM, or maybe they're already there, but boy, to have a layout system that doesn't need that is pretty fantastic.
Yeah, I would say we have about 80% of our customers right now that are non-BIM or that use BIM on some of their project because they're required to. Also depends on the countries in Europe. At the beginning in Europe, I thought they would use BIM more, but at the end, they're actually worse than here. it's about 80% of our customers that are non-BIM. And it's important for them because for most contractors, it scares them. Even very large companies are not using BIM right now. So we needed to have a solution that fits both contractors. That's I would say the repartition of contractors.
Whenever you're talking about something as substantial as suicide awareness and as alarming as to statistics around construction being the second highest rates of suicide in industry, we'd be fooling ourselves if we thought that this was a one-player fix, meaning that it just takes one silver bullet or one easy button to solve this challenge. This is a multi-threaded challenge, if you will, and it's really something that is the responsibility of all of us to lean in, to raise awareness, to provide tools and resources, to up-level conversations we have around, in construction, we're pretty much, hey, what's my job require me to get it done at any cost? Well, we now see what the outcome of that is. So I think it's important that we partner together to really have a unified voice around why mental health awareness is important, why it matters, and how we can frankly do better as an industry. It takes each of us leaning in to really create that.
Is there any necessity? Because you do project tracking too. So you're laying out, you're pulling all that data back in, you're tracking sort of where the job is at any point in time. Is any of that require BIM to work, or are you getting most of the workflow you described for those non-BIM contractors?
I would say BIM is much more useful for general contractors and MEP contractors, but all the rest, it's not necessary, I would say. It depends on the project. Of course, if you're a wall and ceiling contractor and you want to move into prefabrication, BIM will be the solution because you need to be accurate when you lay out something and then when you prefabricate something and you put it on the project, right? But even then, it's not all contractors that perform prefabrication. Some of the top 10 and top 50 actually in the US are starting to do it. In Canada, it's not very common right now. So it's not a necessity, definitely not. But I believe it would boost your company. But it takes 5 years at least to build a decent team that can perform BIM for your project. And that can be scary for some contractors.
Well, it can be scary and it can be costly, right? That's the other problem. So much of what causes us issues in the change, John, during the period of getting someone from 2D to 3D is we can't make mistakes, and we do make mistakes. So this is also a fabulous way to do both without double overhead and maintaining a competitive advantage too. Let's not be the wall and ceiling is in so many different types of construction, right? That a lot of those are seeing a dip right now due to, you know, whatever you want to say, but, you know, interest rates, et cetera. So you've got, you know, wall and ceiling contractors getting involved in different kinds of work, especially because we've got booms in other areas. So you need that accuracy and you need to be able to, quote unquote, sit at the big table. And, you know, this is framers allowing them an opportunity to sit at that big table and actually, I would say, kind of swing their weight around a little bit. Because if you can be in the field with a product like this, with the technology that speaks to accuracy, speaks to collaboration, speaks to getting the job done right, now you've got a real advantage from a business perspective as a major contractor. When maybe, you know, like you said, I'd rather be competitive in what's a ramp up time? Probably like 6 months, maybe to yeah. Rather than 5 years.
Yeah.
So he mentioned the hardware and we haven't talked about that.
Yeah.
I can see it behind you, but you know, people that are just listening can't really understand. Can you give us some of the sort of key information about your hardware? You know, are you purchasing it? Did you produce it yourself? Battery life, you know, some of the things that people need to think about on the hardware side when they're looking at a solution like this.
Yeah. So it got to be custom. To be honest, if someone is pulling up a bunch of products off the shelf and putting them together, it's not going to work out properly. So, you know, for us, it's very important to have the accuracy, but also consistency over harsh conditions, high and low temperatures, atmospheric pressure, and so on and so forth. So for this, we need to be custom. Basically, how our laser projection work, it's one laser beam that is reflected on two mirrors that we call galvanometers. And those two mirrors, one is from the x-axis and the other one is from the y-axis. And they control the beam onto a surface that completes a loop based on your CAD file, but operates this so quickly that the human eyes cannot see the difference between the point that is moving to a total line and total projection. So it's similar to like cathodic TVs that we had before, but enabled for the job site, basically. When users want to look for laser projection, I believe the most important thing, they need to look for ergonomy, because you'll need to carry it on your project up the stairs because you don't necessarily have elevators on all your project. You'll need to look for accuracy. You'll need to look for entire workflow from the software base, how this is going to operate altogether. And then at the end, flexibility. So you need to make sure that your product can withstand high and low temperatures depending on where you use it, vibration resistance, impact resistance, and so on and so forth. So to do so, everything needs to be custom. On our side, we develop our own lasers, we develop our own mechanical, we customize our galvanometers. We have a pretty qualified team to do so. And that's super important to get to the standards that our customer requires.
And you guys are a manufacturer as well then. So you are fully manufacturing this from a beginning to end.
We don't necessarily manufacture our mechanical parts, so we buy them, but we do assembly of our product and calibration of our product. And really, calibration is an important piece of our assembly process and also considered as a trade secret. So it's super important to have the calibration done right so that it can withstand months and months on the job site without needing to recalibrate the equipment.
You know, when you first started talking about your pivot over to this product, that was based on just really being aware of how your product's being received. As you've started to test with this product, are you seeing any use cases that really are surprising to you? Or have you been pretty good at guessing what it was going to be used for?
Yeah, yes. I never thought we would be doing marine construction, for example. So yeah, it's actually a market. Same for proof application. I haven't thought about it, but then the more I got requests from customers, the more it makes sense because you can bring your proof application to site afterwards using the same device. It's quite easy for contractors to operate this. So yes, we did have a lot of requests from different types of contractors to use our product in different ways. But it's important for us not to diverge at the same time, especially we're an early business, right? And we're just getting started really about the commercialization of our product. So we need to make sure we're laser focused on some trades and that we can grow within those trades before scaling horizontally our product.
That's a nice little pun there. You got to stay laser focused with your lasers.
Yeah.
but I like this now because you hit two things: marine construction. If I'm not mistaken, you mean building boats.
Yeah.
Like large boats. It's funny. You're not the first of our technologies for me to see somebody cross that line over. So it's very interesting, and we call that artful use, right? Like if we're going to produce it, we're going to do this set of things with it. If you want to try and do other things at your own risk, feel free. I'm interested though. The marine's one thing, right? It's basically, I mean, those things are so big. It is a building, right? So
yeah,
you're basically building a building that has to float. It has a different set of engineering rules beyond just standing. It has to actually float and operate and et cetera. But I mean, they're giant. So it is bigger than a lot of buildings that we build. I'm interested in the prefabricated, if you can break that down a little bit, because I think these are also earlier, like newer to prefabrication. Like when we think prefab in the MEP space, especially the mechanical space, like we're doing a lot of BIM. These are complicated. We're making entire skids at times. We're making overhead racking, even underground, right? That's done that way. And there's a difference. This is more, if I'm hearing it, for, again, folks that are bridging into prefabrication. So are they, tell me how that one works for them, what that use case looks like.
Yeah, so it's going to be a little bit different for prefabrication because they won't have necessarily a huge construction plan to put on a device, but it's going to be multiple very small plans, right? So we've done projects for welders that assembled stair rails. So that was one of the projects we've done. So we're attaching our product to the wall, and then we're projecting the information into a welding table. We've also done prefabrication for wall panels. And so that they can position their studs and so on and so forth. So the wall panel is standing, and we're projecting directly into the wall structure that guides the contractors at the end. But the major difference, I mean, to the usage of the product, it will be quite similar, right? You'll position it in the somewhat similar ways. But the difference will be how you manage your CAD files. That is going to be a huge difference. So this is why it needs to be simple to import like 50 different CAD files into your web platform and access them into your project, into your assembly shop easily. So I would say that's the biggest difference that we've seen so far in terms of customer demand for prefabrication.
It's interesting, man, because if we look back, AR, we were looking at that, Jonathan, too, at that point. Like we thought AR would be what they were doing, putting it on and in the fab shop doing that. And in fact, if you look back, you know, way back when Martin Brothers, they had the bathroom pod assembly, you know, old school versus new school with AR. But again, it always felt pretty out there and pretty hard to get to that point. This seems much simpler, and you can see it, you know, being, you know, the laser showing what to do, like been building that railing or building that wall panel. It's kind of funny that you went all the way from 3D printed wall panels back to helping them prefabricate the wall panels so they could put them in the right place. Like, I feel like the three of you probably had like that in the back of your head. Like, we're still going to solve that problem, whether you like it or not, maybe just differently. So
Yeah, that's true.
I will say that the first time I saw Laser Likers was last year at a fabrication convention for MCAA. Ryan Hoggett at UMC over there, he had it in his fab shop. And he was just kind of like, hey, everybody, check this out. You know, this is a great way to lay out modules and other things in a fixed location. You know, we like you said, I think a lot of these fab shops that are at the higher end, they have the CAD problem figured out. It's really, how do we communicate with the people there? But, you know, that kind of leads me to, so what do you're a relatively young company. You're doing your own engineering. You're doing your own design. You're kind of, you know, steering your own ship. What can we expect to see soon from you? Like what's the next step for Framer?
Are you a construction company that's inundated with applications? Are you struggling to get technology adoption? Are you worried you're creating data silos? We refer to that as gray work. You want to learn more about gray work and how leading construction companies are getting past it? Then join me at QuickBase's Empower 2024. Go to quickbase.com/empower.
Yeah, so this is our generation 2. Right now, we're about to release our generation 3. And that's going to be a leap ahead from the generation 2, to be honest. So we worked on it for the past year and a half. All the learnings that we've done from that generation, we improved it into generation 3. And really, generation 3 will expand beyond use cases that I've just mentioned, and we'll produce in larger quantities. So we'll have our international certification. We'll be able to ship in more than 58 countries. And that's going to be a nice journey to have. And also building a factory to assemble them in larger quantity, increase our quantity, our production capacities, and so on and so forth. So that's really the next steps for us. And the Gen 3 is the most important piece of it. And the product will change name as well. That's kind of a scoop. Because FrameR is mostly for framing, as you can imagine, right? And throughout the years, we've discovered that we have much more use cases. So the product will change its name as well.
That one will hopefully we'll be involved in letting that one out when that comes out. So I'll jump on with Jonathan there. You're going to go to version 3. What's ahead? So you talked about, I'll bring it back to Jonathan's original point too, that he got ahead of ourselves with it. You're also looping back the information. Now you're using the feedback loop to train the device, but you were mentioning you see some other use cases for the entire project team to use that data as it comes back. Are there plans to expand that, and your thoughts about what that would look like for the entire project team?
What we've realized working with general contractors is basically that they don't necessarily want to own layout because of they don't want to have the responsibility of layout, right? But in the end, that's not really true. They're just scared of not knowing what's happening on the project, and that costs them a lot of money, because if a subcontractor move a wall or an anchor, for example, it will have a repercussion afterwards, and they need to know this information to relay this information to the other trades. So right now we're building our platform. So our platform is already operating, but we're adding on features to make this data fully accessible to general contractors afterwards. So therefore, a general contractor could not even be operator of an equipment. And if he wants to adhere to a project, then he can have access to that information to help him manage his project. And we're talking about 3D point cloud, surface flatness reports. We're talking about a complete change log of all the modification that happened on the project. Even if it's a millimeter modification, we'll be able to tell the contractors for it. And then much more information as well, tracking progress about layout and so on and so forth. And you need to understand that layout is not necessarily an expensive task, but it's leading the timeline of the project. Nobody can go faster than the layout guy. It's impossible, right? Because it's dictating the timeline. So if you're able to accelerate this timeline, it will have also an important repercussions into your project, and you can accelerate your Gantt chart. So we can provide this information as well to the contractors.
Yeah, that's a super powerful leading indicator, right? We're always looking for even the most minute leading indicator that we're getting off that bell curve of how we're headed onto a job. If we're staying flatlined, and the flat line is a lot of the time, it's moving just a little. And if it's not moving, that is the layout team. That's the team that's getting out there and getting ahead. And also, you know, if deviations are caught early, right? Which is what you're talking about. They can prevent, you know, it's one thing if I catch a deviation on the first floor before I'm going up higher, and that deviation by math becomes greater and greater as we go higher and higher, depending on what you're doing, or farther and farther down the run, I can fix it. Once I'm down the run, I can't fix it. Now I'm change order. Now I'm suing. Now we're, you know, it's fisticuffs, so to speak, our version of it, you know, email fisticuffs, so to speak, or we let the lawyers fight it, whatever one. So it's a fabulous opportunity to push forward. And to make, and John, you got to love this, to democratize the access to this type of technology, no matter if you're BIM, 2D, really no matter where you are in the process, especially because, you know, how many total stations do we know from our history got used by one person who knew how to use it, and now they're sitting in a cabinet gathering dust because that person moved on or their job was beyond that point, right? So again, this is much easier technology to consume and use and get trained on. So that's maybe where I want to end it with you, William. How fast can somebody get up and running on this? What's the ramp up speed for you guys?
Yeah, so we provide a training in 3 hours. So complete training, right? We stay one day with the worker, one full day. During that day, it's 3 hour training, and then we just watch him work and give him some advices. The second day, we come back on the job site only in one morning, and then we guide the user again. And then we'll be operating the units for 1 week. After 1 week, it tripled its productivity rates, I'm sure about it. So it's quite fast to be able to learn the usage of our product.
Yeah. And you know, that's, you made a statement about not being a surveyor. So I was a surveyor, which is why I did well with the total station. Because I was a surveyor for like 2 years before I got mine. But you're right. That's the hard training part, right? Because Jeff had this huge smile. He's like, what do you mean that fast? And it's like, if you don't have to teach them to be a surveyor at some level, all of a sudden, especially with your workflow, because you didn't mention it, but I think it should be mentioned. There's a huge difference between trying to put a dot in the center of like a point that a laser lays out and tracing a line that the laser lays out. Because a lot of people out there, they're like, oh, well, I have a laser on my job site. Yep. And it makes a little ellipse and you have to get right in the middle of that little ellipse. And then you might still be off and you're not sure what that point is. But man, if it draws a line, I'm pretty sure I know that that's a wall. You know, so it really is amazing product. I definitely need to talk to you offline for a little bit.
Well, it sounds like we're all going to have to get together because this is something I'm going to throw it out there. At some point, I want to get trained on how to use this. I've never been trained on a total station again because it goes beyond. We all know what I'm good at and what I'm not good at. At least I know what I'm good at and not good at. And that's not one of them. So this might be one even I can get my hands on and we can play with. So I think the three of us are going to have to meet up at some point and try this sucker out. Maybe even get me trained on it, John. What do you think?
That would be great.
I think this one might be up your alley, Jeff. I think you can think of some artful use for this one.
Well, that was what I was thinking, William. So the challenge has been thrown. At some point, William, we'll get together in person and we'll try me on Framer of the Future, whatever name is going to be next. And you let us know when that name changes. Before that name changes, though, let everybody know how they can kind of find out more about what you've got out there.
Yeah, definitely. I think the easiest way is to go and watch our website, www.mechassist.ca, or directly contact me. So my email is williamstpierre@mechassist.com. I'm very sorry about this. So that would be the easiest way to reach me out or reach one of our sales team.
Well, we'll be sure to tag you and all of that, but I'm pretty sure as soon as this one comes out, before I even get a chance to tag you, you'll probably be getting a call from a few of our friends. So thank you so much for joining us. You're going to stick around because it's time for the Construction Technology News of the Week. Back in 2020, I heard about a new software platform called Join. Within minutes of seeing Join, I knew it had the power to revolutionize collaborative project delivery. In fact, I was so sold on Join that I joined the team as its industry evangelist. Many trade shows and podcasts later, Join is now used by 50% of the ENR top 30. Why? Pre-con and ops leaders at DPR, Bolt, McCarthy, Barton Mallow, Clark, and others say that they like Join because it does two big things: collaborative, trackable decision-making, and awesomely simple visuals. Want to learn more about the power of Join? go to www.join.build/demo to learn about how better gets built.
I feel like I need to call them out today. So a lot of this stuff that I have today, the AI breakdown, the daily breakdown, has been a sort of something I've been listening to off and on, and they keep hitting these articles that I love. And this is one that I really love, and it's in praise of boring AI. And they mean just boring AI. All of these boring tasks that we have to do, that we, you know, while we listen to all the hype cycle, make this the next huge thing. This article says, hey, wait. Here are all the boring things that are really essential that this helps you do. And more than that, it helps you fight being bored. And they point out that being bored is actually something that's a real problem. They even did this study, and it was, would you rather be bored for 15 minutes or you can shock yourself? And people were shocking themselves rather than being bored for 15 minutes. They found out that people in war, when they're bored, are more sadistic, all of these bad things. And so what this article really doubles down on is what probably a lot of the people listening are using AI to do. These boring, tedious tasks. And Jeff, you know, I do a lot of consulting on technology, and they're like, how do I get technology adoption? And I said, go around, figure out what people hate to do. And whatever they hate to do, that's where you put in the technology first. I mean, forget all those other things, because your people are going to be, and he underlines it, they're going to be happier. They're going to have a better workday, and they're going to spend their time on these creative tasks rather than on boring tasks. And I read through it a couple times. It's back from August. And I just think he hit it so well. You know, we hear about all these amazing things that AI is going to do. And then all of a sudden we're like, well, wait a second. The amazing thing for me was I needed my Excel broken up into 20 parts. And instead of doing that, I just said, here's the file. Can you break this up into 20 parts? And it did it, you know? So did you get a chance to look at that at all?
I actually dig this, Jonathan, because for me, it's always about why, right? I'm always about why. And why do we need AI? We do need AI to get rid of the boring things. So we talk about this ad nauseum, especially in the construction world, that we are going out and recruiting new people to come into this fantastic industry. And what is their first internship over a summer? They're moving data from one system to another, or they're filling out every log. So we're getting them like 50 to 100 yards from an incredible experience of building a structure, a wastewater treatment plant, a new high rise, a stadium. And we're like, but you're going to sit in this almost windowless, stanky trailer with a big laptop and two screens, and you're just going to type all day, and your eyes are going to hurt when you leave. And you might take a glimpse of this incredible thing that you're building. And yeah, this is where we can automate so much with AI. Plus, I mean, we talk about this as well. A lot of what we do in the process, especially as we're training new people, is that when one event happens, so I'll take this to William, when an anchor is out of place, what do we do? Okay. When we bring new people in, they don't know. They start running around trying to figure out what the heck it is we're supposed to do. Well, we know this. AI is great at finding that information, guiding us to what our choices are, and saying, okay, anchor's out of place. You need to let these two teams know immediately. And here's what you need to pose. Or, hey, here's what the soup or the project manager needs to decide. Okay, they don't make the decision. It presents it to you. You make the decision, and then it goes off. Writing that email, writing that communication, or documenting that thing is not the important part. It's what do we do with it so that we can create action. But it is boring. I mean, and how often you do this too, and you know, before ChatGPT, man, you did this way more, is you just skimmed and hope you caught the thing and did it. And how many times were you freaking wrong? Because you're like, there was this asterisk or this, if this, see this, and you didn't see that. And you may have just taken us down a spot where you assumed the risk. So I love it. William, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on, you know, AI removing boring things and getting people to, I love not being bored, man. I just think that's awesome.
Yeah, no, it's super important. You mentioned like clash detection as well. When you need to move around an anchor, that's super important. For me, I use a lot of AI to accelerate my task on a daily basis. Just writing emails. I write 20 to 30 emails a day minimum. And it helps me out to make sure that my emails are sharp every time, right? So that's super important. I love it. And in the construction space, there's a lot of potential avenues to use AI that will significantly change the way we work and share information with different parties. So yes, I agree with you, Jeff. It's going to be a life changer.
I'm going to bring it back before you do that. I'm going to go to a Mark Twain quote. And I think if we could bring Mark Twain all the way forward, he'd love this. I didn't have time to write a short letter, so I wrote a long one instead. And here's a great piece is you can now take that letter, throw it in, get back something much shorter, has the same point, and is much more consumable and saves everybody a little bit of time. You didn't know I was going to go to Mark Twain, did you, John?
No, I didn't think you'd go to Mark Twain, man. But, you know, you brought up a really important thing about interns that I want to underline. If your intern's job is to get coffee and make copies, you will not end up with that intern. If when they come to me, their job is to go out and build stuff, I will get that intern. You will not get that intern.
Or at least go use a laser, right, John? I mean, if it's like, hey, go use a laser and go do some QA.
Absolutely go use a laser. I definitely would hand a new tech, and I often did hand new technology to interns because no one knows it. So you're not, you know, losing any tribal knowledge, man. Somebody's got to learn it from scratch. So my next one, in a way, is AI related, but not really. And that's the global race for the humanoid robot. I figured if my first one was about ignoring the hype, my next one should be about like doubling down on it. So this one basically is saying that the race for the humanoid robot is our space race. This is it. This is all the different countries sort of getting together and trying to prove that they have the biggest robot. You know what I mean? Or the best robot. And it was a neat article. It does point out some of the countries that you might not have thought about. I mean, part of the kickoff of this is the Saudi robot. I'm not sure if you heard about this. There was a Saudi robot accused of sexual harassment for touching the bottom of a reporter. The video was everywhere. And I think anybody watching the video is like, it looks like he was trying to push you away from it. But regardless, whoever is the marketing genius that said this is like that video, everybody has seen the Saudi robot at this point. But China's decided they're going to mass produce robots by 2025. You know, we are constantly going after robots. And the reason this is important and the reason I sort of align it with the boring AI article is the non-boring stuff that AI is doing is making robots something that actually act like the robots we saw when we were a kid watching cartoons. They can talk to us. They can understand what we're saying. They can understand an environment to a certain extent. I think I talked about that the last time we were on together, Jeff. But I also think this is the ultimate hype cycle. I mean, you have people that don't even believe there was a moon landing, that it was literally just two countries that were hyping each other up. And one just is like, we'll pretend, you know? So I thought it's good to bring awareness to the hype cycle of the humanoid robot. It is definitely a passion. And I definitely think we will get to the humanoid robot pretty quick. Cause all our tools are made for humans, man. But what do you think, Jeff? I mean, do you think it is the space race again?
Oh, I do. I do. I think that's the cool part of it, right? I think so. I did. And I'll call out some of our great friends out there that had to go after me at Autodesk University on the, they had a, like a TED style stage that we would do these 15-minuters. And I proposed, you know, something about robots. And nobody knew that it was a gag. It was a joke. It really was. Because I've said this and I will say this till forever. This thing right here, this human, is like the most poorly engineered thing to do 90% of the jobs that we do. So reproducing me as a robot is pretty much creating one of the most useless robots on the planet to do any specific job. That's why when you see a specific robot for a specific job, it doesn't look like me. It doesn't. It looks like a small track wheel that needs to get around, or even, you know, we used to joke that, you know, great, thanks a lot, Boston Dynamics. You gave us a robot and then you gave it a pet dog, so we can't even be the pet anymore. But Spot has a very usable mechanism. And of course, they should be mimicked off of certain things in nature because they were, you know, evolved that way. But again, the human is not the way. However, if you look at the space race, the winner wasn't the person that put the flag up there. It was the rest of society that got a microwave, that got all of this technology that could feed other devices, all of the ancillary things that come out of great people pushing for such incredibly, you know, moonshot ideas. That's what people fail to realize. Like, William, you're building things yourself. How many of these things that you didn't understand when it comes to temperature and pressure and atmospheric pressures and all of those things are they going to have to deal with to create a robot that then a new material comes out you can consume and it can help you in what you're doing? So to me, John, this is why the race is so great, because of all the ancillary things that it creates in the long run, including technologies themselves, right? Including platforms. If you're going to interface and have an AI inside of a robot that's doing anything, that's some advanced technology. That's some innovation that we didn't see before. So again, that's just going to drive us in hardware, software, all the things that we do. So William, I'm interested now, you know, what are your thoughts on the, are you going to pivot now and you're building a robot tomorrow?
No, I won't pivot. But yeah, I agree with you. You know, the technology invention that are getting out of those creative companies are amazing. Like, I've seen the video from the company called Figure. They recently raised like $600 million or something like this. And you know, the robot is doing a very simple task. I mean, putting a coffee pot into the coffee machine. But at the same time, it realizes if the coffee pot is not well placed and is trying to figure out a way to put it correctly. And that's amazing because it's the perfect conjuncture between mechanical design and artificial intelligence to bring somewhat to the real world. And that I found it amazing, to be honest. So I know, I mean, it's a very simple task. I mean, we do this on a daily basis. But from an engineering standpoint, it's a major leap from what we did a few years ago.
Yeah. I remember that video that Boston Dynamics put out about the robot Atlas going and getting, you know, the tools that you need. And I'm like, that is a really expensive intern. I mean, at least the interns on the job site, if they're going to get the jobs and they're learning the right tools for what you're doing. However, again, it's the ancillary stuff. So Jonathan, man, any last thoughts? Cause that's a nice little combo you got there.
Yeah. You know, I think my last thought would be, if you go up to the Boring article, they talk about what we should replace with AI and they're like dangerous stuff. You know, in order to get rid of the dangerous stuff in construction, a humanoid robot would be a big step. We put our construction workers in some horrible situations physically. You know, I've been on job sites where you're on, you know, it's petroleum and they're like, everything has cancer on it here. Like, you know, you wear gloves at all times and a respirator. And, you know, we don't need that with a robot. You know, we talk about the space race and getting out there and getting to these far off planets. Well, you know, that takes a lifetime or it takes a robot. You know, and so there's a level at which I think it really opens some doors. I am happy that we are racing after this. I mean, I wanted to go to the moon, but I actually want a humanoid robot more.
Yeah, well, I could think of a number of ways, Jonathan, that we can use those things. Whether I joke that it won't look like, I don't think the end ones that really do the work for us will look like us. But if you think about this, I mean, Tanis just shared this the other day. Another group of people died in a trench accident. Right. If you bury a robot, you cost us a whole bunch of money, but it's a buried freaking robot. We'll get it out. We'll repair it. And it's not a human. We are very dangerous. I was, you know, at AGC IT Forum last summer and I was walking with Matt Lamb and he was just articulating the heat that the team at Rosendin was dealing with in Phoenix, building out some of the new projects they were on in trench work, and that it was 130, you know, relative temperature. Like, if we can do, you know, imagine that person is now sitting in a trailer with a setup and operating it on a joystick. And okay, you burned out a part. You overheated it. Okay. You know, what do you do when you overheat your car? You go get that cup of coffee and you wait for it to cool back down. So there's numbers of different ways. And I'm with you, man. I would love that.
Yeah, I will say one last thing, and only because William's on here. If the sensor that William has that's going to tell you when things move, when you move it from side to side, if they're in a ditch and they see that the soil is moving towards them from yesterday, like the soil has moved, they know. They can tell us. You won't see it with your eye, but if you're taking measurements like that, all of a sudden there's a bigger safety factor anyways. So it is, I'm very excited, very, very excited to see what they get to. Good race to be in.
Love it. Love it. It's a great time. It's a great time for that race too. So I'm going to spin us though, because I got my friends out there and I have protected my personal computers and my family's personal computers and just about everybody I know since the beginning that these guys showed up on the scene. Malware Bytes, love them. If you don't know about it, it's a great malware platform to protect you. And no, we don't have a sponsorship from them. Although, you know, I wouldn't, it's like the one we do on the Dorks. I wouldn't say no. But this article is about YouTube ordered to reveal the identities of video viewers. So federal U.S. authorities have asked Google for the names, addresses, telephone numbers, and user activity of accounts that watched certain YouTube videos according to unsealed court documents that Forbes has seen. So of those users that weren't logged in when they watched those videos between January 1st and 8th, 2023, the authorities asked for the IP addresses. So this is a huge can of worms, Jonathan, that we started to talk about what you can and can't watch, and then who can know you watch these things. And, you know, all of us can think of times at which, sure, we want to know, but in this one, that the other thing that was a little bit really interesting was that there was a planted video around drones that stayed up there for a while, and then they wanted access to the people who watched those videos. And anybody who knows YouTube knows you start YouTube and the whole idea behind the algorithm is they want your attention. So they're going to bring things up to you. So once you start, you might have started with, hey, I want to know what drones do. And the next thing you know, you're watching a video that then you've got the government knocking at your door. And this is a huge battle. And I learned about a new group, Albert Fox Kahn, the executive director of Surveillance Technology Oversight Project, STOP, said no one should fear a knock at the door from police simply because of what the YouTube algorithm serves up. I'm horrified that the courts are allowing this. So, you know, we've had a couple things on here about drones recently and, you know, DJI and the potential that those will be banned in the United States and banned from being used in certain areas. We're really at an information warfare and a very weird precipice for our data and what they know about us. So, John, I'm interested because you and I had a big Slack run about this one.
Yeah. And you know, it went on to some other conversations and I ended up, I don't know. So I receive books from Library of Congress on a regular basis. Library of Congress, I get a lot of books and read a lot of books from that library. And there was a huge argument about two decades ago about whether the government could look at my record of everything I read and then somehow magically figure out what my intentions were based on the book I read. So this is the same thing. They're going to look at a video and then they're going to magically figure out what your intentions are in watching the video. And it really just feels like, again, a huge overreach, a huge reach into privacy, but also a level of guilty before we even talk to you that just can't happen. It really does go against the way that America works. And I'm just going to say, I'm not doing anything nefarious and I have VPNs and I have fiber or privacy protection out the wazoo. If I was somebody that was actually going to engage in nefarious operations, I'd make darn sure that I'm protected from most of those casual ways to track what we're doing. So why this? why this? You're almost guaranteeing that you're not going to catch the people that are truly sophisticated. And drones are not sophisticated. Like, yes, my daughter made one, but no, she didn't make one that could go miles and miles away and do weird stuff. You know, so I feel like it is a dumb move on the part of the government in asking for this. But I also feel like this has been proven out even before the digital age with books, you know, because, maybe I'm interested in what the Unabomber wrote just out of curiosity. Does it mean that I have any chance of becoming a Unabomber? No. So you have to assume intent. Jeff, I thought it was super interesting. I think it's one of the conversations that everybody needs to have loudly in front of those in power, wherever possible.
I would fully agree with you. And that you formulated another thought I remembered before this that I wanted to bring up is that, like, listen, history doesn't always repeat itself, but it certainly rhymes, is a statement I got from a friend. And like, if you want to know how we got where we are, the Unabomber, how that person thought, where they were. I want people reading this to understand what drove people to where they are, right? An understanding of our past helps us prevent it in the future. It's not about just reading nice books that tell us wonderful things, right? Horrible, nasty things have happened in our world, both on purpose and not. I mean, let's talk about, we haven't done it on the show, but we can talk about the Baltimore Bridge. Like, we need to unpack that, and books need to be written about it, and manuals and safety and all sorts of things need to be done around that. And we need all of that out there, because the bright people of the future that read these things can infer things and prevent them. Right. And I did want to give a shout before I toss it back over to William. I did want to give a shout here, though, because so many of our big tech companies just get beat up for what they do. And on this one, Google came out and said, you know, Google owns YouTube, if you didn't know that. We examine each demand for legal validity consistent with developing case law, and we routinely push back against overbroad or otherwise inappropriate demands for user data, including objecting to some demands entirely. So these folks, while a lot of time, yes, they're harvesting our data, yes, they're trying to serve us the things to get us to click and to take us down their road, but they are also stewarding and protecting our data and protecting us, and at the forefront, John, of a lot of these conversations. And they are, I mean, if they were kowtowing, who knows how bad it would be. So I wanted to give YouTube and the group out there a little bit of a love for, hey, look, big tech is not always bad, man. It's good stuff. So William, I'm interested. What are your thoughts, man? We went down a rabbit hole there on you.
No, but you're right. I mean, it's weird that government have access to our data online, but at the same time, I think everybody knows what's happening, right? And one of the great quote I've seen is from the Second World War fighters, is basically that you need to know that you're dead before you move on into the battlefield to get shit done, right? And it's kind of the same thing with the internet. You know you're being spied all the time. You know it. So now live with it. But the fact that they're coming and knocking at your door, that's clearly something different. I haven't experienced myself. I don't want to experience it. Definitely not.
Me neither. But man, does this make it very interesting that any one of us in our space that researches drones as much as we do and relies on them. I mean, we have said that drones aren't even on our innovation world much anymore because they're quite ubiquitous in the use cases and the ways that they're used. So yeah, you're right. You nailed it. I'm going to spin us and end us on a good note, though. And this one, I mean, it's real brief. Everybody listening now knows that, you know, I'm a Morning Brew fan. So morningbrew.com, great emailer. Tech Brew is an awesome one. I get a lot of my IT news there. But they had this quick one that came by and I had to click it. Gen Z is losing interest in email jobs. More young people are opting out of traditional college and opting into vocational programs. Not a surprise to a lot of us that are on this show. However, a couple of the statistics here I thought was interesting. Why are they doing it? I'm always a why. Get this. Medium pay for construction workers rose more than 5% last year to $48,089 compared to $39,520 for new hires in professional services like accountants and IT workers, according to ADP. So this is, you know, ADP, if you're not familiar with them, huge swath of companies across the country use ADP. So they have an incredible data source to give us this information. Think about that. That's close to $10,000 difference. And it doesn't even take into account, you know, if you talk to debt to income there, because most of those vocational and tech schools, they work through the process, or they're significantly shorter and less expensive, because there are some that are 2-year degrees and you are going to school for 2 years to learn about this stuff. So I just thought this was awesome to see data. And it says the number of students enrolled in vocational focused community colleges increased 16% from 2022 to 2023, according to data from the National Student Clearinghouse. So, John, this has to make you excited, man.
Yeah, I mean, I'm somebody that went to a vocational school. I mean, I went to college for a little bit and honestly got bored and didn't have the time to do it and ended up in the vocational end of things. I really think one of the funny things is we were just talking about what is boring, and we're trying to get rid of the boring tasks of those email jobs. And I hope that A, we get rid of a lot of those boring jobs and we get some of those jobs that are in the corporate world that are fun. So if you go through the bother of going to college, when you come out, you have something to do that's around your major. But I will say that definitely most of the smartest people that I have met on a job site, when I'm like, oh, so what college did you go to? They just start chuckling. And you know, maybe they went to a year here, maybe they went to a year there, but they really learned through apprenticeship. They learned through hands-on. They learned through building. And I think there are a lot of people that want to build, and they've realized that in order to build right now, the path is let's go to tech school. Let's not get a lot of debt. My kids are very, very conscious of the debt that's involved in college. They just really are conscious of that. And I've already had one of them just basically say, nah, that's not the direction I'm going to go. I'm going to go into mechanics. I'm going to go to this. I'm going to go to that. But I just don't want to do that. So I'm happy that it's actually working out that way. Lord knows that if everything does automate in the corporate world, there's less need for the email people and there's more need for the people installing. So very happy to see that statistic is finally moving.
Yeah. William, what are your thoughts, man?
Yeah, I totally agree with both of you. I think it's a very great thing. And especially that I believe in the United States, your student loans, even if you declare personal bankruptcy, you'll still need to get them, right? So that's super complicated. And yeah, I think we need to have more people on the field. I think we need to have more people doing real stuff. And I think that's a great thing. Yeah. And especially the pay right now on the construction projects are very good, especially if you're in a unionized market. It's very decent. It's super great. So definitely it's a great thing.
Yeah. And I don't want, you know, because I have a college degree, you know, and I needed it right at the time. Well, honestly, I mean, a major in biology, a minor in psychology and chemistry. Not sure I really needed that for a gig in IT in the end. I might have been better off going to one of the trade schools. And I'm not saying everyone needs, you know, that we don't need college, right? It's just that we've swung that pendulum way too far the wrong way, and we need to balance it out. Plus, we need more people that can work on things, that work with their hands, that are engaged, because then when they do get educated further because of something they're passionate about. So I could see this, you know, especially out of your, one of your kids, Jonathan, is that, you know, you go the trades route for a while and you're learning and you're building things and you're creating things. And then you have this moment where you go, I want to build a humanoid robot. I need to learn these things. So when I go pick my higher education, it's going to have what I'm looking for. It's going to be to a purpose, and I'm going to come out and end with something that's really palatable. Because whenever I bring up academia in our world, I get this pushback that they're disconnected. They don't know what they're doing. And I'm like, no, that's our fault right now. We need to connect true builders with academia to truly push an industry forward. And academia needs reality built into it. And the only way they're going to get reality is to go out and learn it. And the trade schools and the trades themselves can supply that path to really transforming the way the entire process works, at least in my opinion.
So I would also,
I got on my soapbox there, John.
I'm just going to add one thing. If more people go to trade school gets more money, those labs within trade school start to look better and better and better. You know, I go over to Penn State Bear and they have one of the most fascinating innovation labs you could ever see. It's just full of everything. And it's an engineering school and it's great. And it, you know, it's William, it's full of people like you that come out and instantly are like, I don't even know what I want to build, but I just want to build stuff. And they go and they build these very technical things. And the trade schools have lagged behind due to funding to make the labs that can compete on that level. You get that there, you know, there's a line. And once the trade schools get over that, their labs are going to start looking like some of the best college labs. And a lot of these people that said they have to go to this great college to get into this great robotics program are going to have an alternative where they can stick with robotics. They don't have to take creative cloud watching. You know, they can do just the core bit. And I think there's a time in your life where you want to do that. I'm not against a liberal education. I read all the time, but you know, library card can get you a good part of a liberal education. So
well, and a good AI search can help you a lot as well.
Absolutely. So, absolutely.
You know, just wrap it all up. Listen, both of you guys, so excited. This was so awesome. I knew it would. Thanks again, William, for reaching out. John, thanks for sitting down with me again, buddy.
Right on.
William, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for the invitation. It was a pleasure.
And thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our interview with William St. Pierre. To read all our news stories, learn about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontactcrew.com. This is the Contact Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.